Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 6 of Topical Fever. My name is David Parsons. I cannot thank you enough for listening to the podcast. In this episode, Justin Rogers Cooper joins me once again to talk about climate change, an issue that is important to both of us, and I hope that's important to you, too. In this episode, Justin and I try to hit on some of the more psycho-spiritual dimensions of the climate crisis. That is, we try to uncover the roots of the human impulse to destroy the planet. And in doing so, we talk about things like the rise of industrial capitalism in the 19th century, particularly things like the railroad corporations, and connect those things to contemporary iterations of the same kinds of capitalistic impulses like fracking and the Keystone Pipeline and the BP oil spill. So I thank you for listening to these ideas. And if these ideas are sitting well with you or not sitting well with you, I'd love to hear more about that. We have things like Facebook and Twitter to encourage such conversations. So if you're liking what you hear or not liking what you hear, I'd love to have more of a dialogue with you guys. So I know there's people listening, and I know that you'd love to join the conversation, so please don't be shy about that. And in future episodes, we'll be talking about all sorts of things. I have an episode coming up about apocalyptic visions of film and literature, and I also have an episode about the state of technology and education coming very soon. So I hope you're enjoying Topical Fever, and I hope you enjoy this conversation between Justin Rogers Cooper and I on the issue of climate change. So we had so much to talk about related to climate change that I had to bring Justin back. Justin, there were so many things that we talked about that we missed, meaning that should have come up and we should have talked about more. One of them was Hurricane Sandy, because it's so much a kind of touchstone for our own lives. It's probably the first major intrusion of climate change into our lives here in New York City. So what was that like when that happened to you, for you? Because we talked a lot, and by talked a lot, I think we sent hysterical text messages to each other for a period of about 24 hours. Yeah. So what were your thoughts going into that emergency?
Well, one thing that was I was thinking about going into it was I was remembering Hurricane Irene from the previous year and how everyone felt that was so hyped up by the media and that it was just a big fool's gold. It was just right. It was just a big mirage.
And it didn't pay. Yeah, it didn't pay. Everyone bought lots of bottled water and food, and I mean I felt overprepared. I think I filled my bathtub even, and then Irene kind of fizzled out.
Yeah, and I love how people have like a kind of caustic attitude about that, sort of like, oh, you know, this was just another example of a media event as opposed to a climate event. And so I was a little bit, I don't know, you know, my own mentality was I was one of those people that was saying Irene could be one of the big ones. And, you know, there are people who are in the climate change scientific community and advocacy community here in New York City who actually say that Irene missed being Sandy by just 1 foot of storm surge. Mm. So that if Irene had just tilted to the right or the left by 12 feet and had just been 1% stronger, everything that we associate with Hurricane Sandy would have happened that previous summer. So when people say that it was all overhype, it was only an overhype, according to some of these people who are thinking about this, by 1 foot. So in a weird way, and I hate to say this, I was not hoping that there would be any significant damage to people or the environment. And at the same time, I think we're caught in a perverse bind, because I was kind of hoping that something would happen that would snap people's consciousness a little bit. It sounds gross to say that, but I was kind of hoping that something just dramatic enough would happen so that this would wake people up.
I don't want to skip to the some of the more esoteric thoughts I've had about Sandy, but one of the big ones is the name of the hurricane Sandy, and the etymology of that name being Cassandra, which is I believe the either Greek or Roman. Either way, Cassandra functions as a prophet that nobody listens to.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I, when that happened, and then a few weeks later, the Sandy Hook massacre occurred in Newtown, Connecticut. I felt like that word "Sandy" was kind of slapping us across the face in a really, really profound and strange way. And either way, I think you're right to have this kind of hope that there will be, it's, you're not hoping for a crisis, you're certainly not hoping that people will get hurt, and you're not hoping that there's a tragedy, but at the same time, you want there to be a reality to this for people. You want people to understand that this planetary emergency is an emergency. It's it may not seem like the guy with the gun stalking through the school, but in a larger way, or from a certain perspective, it's like millions of those guys, you know? And so how do we visualize that? And you're right. I think there sometimes that unfortunately has to come into people's own lives in order to get there. I mean, I'm reminded of the guy, the Senator Portman, that just reversed his position on gay marriage because his son is gay and mm-hmm. came out of the closet. And mm-hmm. he's like, well, he said, I'd never thought about it before this way, and that it would actually stop my son from being happy. And so now I support gay marriage. And some of us might think, well, no shit. But, you know, and that's kind of like a revelation that's almost selfish in nature. But at the same time, there is a reality to that. I think there is something to be said for the need for people to connect these issues to their lives. And when you're running from climate change, then you understand it. But
well, another thing to keep in mind is, you know, even if not thinking about the ordinary person, because that's, you know, that's one thing. It certainly changed the discourse of the elite, so that, you know, Michael Bloomberg comes out and, you know, starts to support Obama because he comes from a party that believes in climate change. And Governor Chris Christie all of a sudden brings Obama on board.
Those were extraordinary moments.
Yeah.
And it shifted the politics.
That's right. And Governor Cuomo gives a press conference.
And some might call that very cynical.
Well, sure. But Governor Cuomo also gives a press conference where he says climate change is a reality that cannot be denied anymore. And that is a discursive shift among the bipartisan elite,
right,
of people who are saying, well, you know, maybe this isn't this isn't something we can ignore any longer. And the reason I think getting into those people's heads is important is because, you know, there is a political calculus that they've been making all along, saying we're going to deny this for votes, you know, for Republican votes. And at the same time, we can't deny it any longer because, you know, the center of capitalism, New York City, ground to a screeching halt. And the rumor that the stock market or the stock exchange was flooded, which turned out to be false,
right,
is nonetheless suggestive about people's fears. And, you know, rumors play vital roles in terms of circulating for according to a social logic, even if it doesn't circulate according to a truth logic. And I think that flooding of the stock exchange both represents what we talked about last time, which is the kind of the weird catastrophic hopes that some people have, which might be or probably are problematic,
mm-hmm.
about the kind of bringing to a halt a system that's bent on exponential growth and destruction, and at the same time represents the fears of the elite, who have to think to themselves, wait a minute, this empire, this financial empire that we've built up in the heart of Manhattan is extremely vulnerable and it's extremely fragile, and it speaks to their fears and challenges the ways in which they've imagined austerity and public infrastructure, and will continue to challenge those people to think in new ways. But those aren't the ways, you know, that I think we would be wanting everyone to think.
Okay, so I think we both agree that Sandy was a moment where, at least in our immediate area, New York politicians, there's been a little bit of a sea change in the way they approach the ideas of climate change. They're actually willing to talk about it and address it. But if I can play the role of like a cynic or devil's advocate or whatever, I mean, I think we both would also agree that the nature of change that needs to take place and to the system that we currently have, and I mean system, capitalism, globalization, industrialization, whatever, the nature, the depth of the, and scale of the changes that has to take place is so much more than just a few politicians knowing that climate change is real and acknowledging it. And in fact, it would require almost a reversal of the whole civilization Is that right? Am I wrong to think that? I mean, we need to stop everything.
Well, I think there are people who would say that's not true because we have alternative energy infrastructures that are ready to come online. And I'm skeptical of that argument, but I think that those people could be right in many, 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 many different kinds of ways. I think that as far as a civilization based on a fossil fuel economy, mm-hmm. that really has to shut down tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Okay. So that's what I was thinking today this morning as I was kind of running through like how do we approach this problem, and sometimes I have a tendency to look at it from the perspective of an alien, like a space alien, and we've talked about this before, the kind of like wide view on like if you were a space alien observing this planet and seeing the creatures that inhabit it behave in this way, what would you suggest they do in order to save themselves? And I try and think that way, and it's weird. I guess in a strange way, it describes my politics as like a space alien that kind of sympathizes with the radical left a lot, or at least sees their ideas as approximating something that might be the right direction to go. But either way, it seems like if I were that alien, I would say, well, you guys obviously have to stop producing stuff. Like you have to stop producing things immediately, and I mean everything. I mean basically anything that's not food, shelter, water, or medicine, or maybe computers and electricity. Anything that's being manufactured just has to. We have to stop that process now. And anyone that and the people, I think the response to any by any rational person to that idea would be that's absurd. Like that would the entire world economy would crash if we stopped producing things. But isn't that the nature of the problem right there?
Well, I think there. Well,
we can't stop doing.
It's the input and the output of the system. So I think there are people that would say we need to control the input and the output. So the input would be the energy inputs. So that there are people that would say you don't need to change or shut down the entire economy and manufacturing and industrialism, et cetera. You need to change the energy that is the input for that system. And that's where people would say we need alternative energy. And then there's the output, conversation, which is this system generates vast amounts of waste, and this is the argument of Vance Packard, who wrote the book, mm-hmm. The Waste Makers, mm-hmm. who was the one who kind of brought this idea of planned obsolescence.
Yeah.
This idea that, Apple makes phones that are going to break in 3 years so that you have to buy another one. That the waste...
And then you just throw that phone in a pile.
That's right.
That just rots into the soil.
That's
and,
right.
And winds up in the flesh of animals that we eat.
That's
and
right.
In the cancerous tumors that kill us.
That's right. And also, exactly. Because the toxins and all the other kinds of secretions that are expelled through the actual production of the commodity, of the economy, those kinds of secretions are themselves toxic, such as, and this has nothing to do with energy. This has to do with the toxin and the waste and the pollution, which is, there's a factory on the edge of Lake Erie, and in order to cool down the pipes from its, steam turbines, it sucks in water from the lake. Mm-hmm. But as this water passes through its metal pipes, the water takes on all kinds of chemicals from the plant, and then it gets dumped right back out into the water, into the lake, and then all these kinds of ecosystems that are relying upon and sensitive to clean water go into a collapse, and then all of a sudden this factory, which is creating pollution that's not energy pollution, it's not carbon pollution, it's chemical pollution, is now destroying this ecosystem, which is wreaking havoc on animal, plant, and human life. And I think that that's part of how complex this conversation is, because even if we say we can change the energy input, which is everything runs on solar panels, just imagine that,
right?
And we have a decentered smart energy grid, in which there's a solar panel on every building, on every house, and everyone
take it even further, have zero energy, like zero point energy, anti-gravity energy, the kind of stuff of science mm-hmm. fiction.
Like
imagine that
fission, nuclear fission.
I mean, this is another show, and I definitely want to get there. But both the two summer blockbusters last year, comic book blockbusters, of Dark Knight Rises and The Avengers, were about the threat of zero point energy and the idea that mm-hmm. This kind of science mm-hmm. fiction idea that there would be a magical, magic bullet that'll solve our energy problems, and that would actually be a bad thing for the Earth because it would spin
That's
everything
funny, yeah.
into crisis. But
the free energy is a threat,
right? Right, because the real apocalypse.
Dark Knight Rises, brought to you by Exxon.
Right, right, and free energy as a threat reminds me of like Zizek's idea, which is like the real threat is our real apocalypse is the collapse of capitalism. Like that's how we imagine the end of the world, not necessarily of buildings collapsing, but of the system that we mm-hmm. that we have collapsing. But in either case, the idea of zero point energy. So you're saying like, okay, what if we develop, okay, thank God, you know, we can now keep the whole thing going and yep. we can keep making iPhones
with no carbon pollution every
3 years with no pollution.
No carbon pollution. Because the thing is, even if you solve the input crisis of the fossil fuel inputs and the carbon that comes from that, you still are left with the poison Lake Erie and the poison streams and the factory farms and everything else that comes on the other side of that economic equation, which means
it doesn't really take care of the externalities right. that are being produced.
And it goes back to the Rachel Carson stuff in the Silent Spring, which yeah. is we're still left with toxins. We're still left with cancer. We're still left with air pollution that gets into your lungs. We're still left with water pollution. We're still left with all the things the EPA was originally invented to legislate or mm-hmm. to effectively regulate. It's just that the planetary emergency that's brought on by climate change in the sense that within 50 years, climate stability will be over and the majority of everyone on the planet will be facing catastrophic risks to their everyday ability to reproduce their lives. That gets taken off the table if you can take the fossil fuels off the table. Mm. And I think that a lot of people would be very interested in taking the carbon crisis off the table and then trying to mitigate or adapt to the toxin crisis, because that actually is the story of the 20th century. The EPA under Nixon mm-hmm. is invented mm-hmm. to say, okay, let's try to buffer the worst consequences of agrochemicals and pesticides. And let's try to take the worst ones off the table.
Right.
But let's keep the whole machine going. And I think that as we saw from the 1970s when the Earth Movement began, at least in the United States, the majority of people who are interested in, you know, possessive consumerism and possessive individualism and see themselves as these sovereign agents who deserve everything, you know, these imperial citizens, they think that their rights to consume are generally more valuable than the rights to clean air, clean water, and a clean future. And it's only the catastrophic emergency of climate change which is beginning to wake up those people who had made compromises, the boomers, really.
Right.
And it's causing the children of the boomers to say, whoa, we need like a huge reboot of the entire thing. And mm-hmm. I think that's the way that me and you are playing with this. And I think that, you know, and this is something I want to get to at some point in the show, is in order to reboot our way of thinking about this planetary crisis, we really have to move from imagining the solution to climate change as one that's technological into one that's political. But I take that one step further and say, in reimagining our kind of political economic system in order to get to a better ecological future, we actually have to do some hard looking in the mirror about who we are and what we've inherited from the people that made this system, which means I think going back into like the moments of Western colonization.
Yeah,
the ideas that fueled the new world.
Yeah, I mean, we have to have. I take it, you take it as a political thing, and I think you're getting at something that I would call, you know, it's a cultural and spiritual project.
Yes,
it really is about taking the American and Western eyeballs out of our heads and putting in new eyeballs that see things in a more appropriate and sustainable context. And that's something that is a much, much larger process. I mean, the way I think about it is, I often think about it as you know, we're on this big, giant cruise ship and we're headed towards the iceberg, and we all have to, we can't turn this ship very quickly. We have to. In order to avoid the iceberg that's coming, we all have to, you know, work together in some way. We have to mm-hmm. Recognize and see it, and then maybe everyone start, you know, running to one side of the ship and leaning
yes.
very hard in one direction.
Yes.
Because otherwise, we're just all partying until we get to the end of it.
The intellectual and social movement for climate stability is the inevitable and logical heir to decolonization in mm-hmm. the 1950s and 1960s, and is the heir to abolitionism, because the same systems of thought that were used to enslave peoples of the global South, of Africa, of South mm-hmm. America, those same systems of thought are the ones that are responsible for the destruction of the planet and for the like ceaseless waste that's produced.
I think of it as one beast that we're still kind of dealing with, that beast yes. that rose out. And, you know,
yes.
I know you're a big 19th century person, so I'll bring this up, is that, you know, this week in one of my classes, we're doing one of my U.S. history survey classes, we were doing the Gilded Age, you know, and we're talking about industrialization during the latter half of the 19th century, which is really where this beast kind of defined itself post-slavery, right? The beast became a much more advanced organism. And by that, I mean the beast began a process of taking over the state in a much more advanced way, and the
corporate state,
right? And we are reading, I think I've mentioned before, we're reading Howard Zinn's People's History, because I want them to see at least see that interpretation. And what they ended up putting up on the board, because I have the students come up and kind of put their own interpretations of what's going up on the board, is we're talking about railroads, and the railroad companies are just such perfect lenses onto what you're talking about of this process of how because the railroads are kind of enslaving the Chinese to build them. They are killing Indians in Indian attacks and doing all sorts of basically genocidal type maneuvers, the kind of things that Israel does to Palestinians today, and the kind of like move out of the way type stuff. But they also began defrauding the government by overcharging them, doing like Zinn talks about the twisting roads theory, which was they would tell the government that the tracks had needed to be much longer than they actually were. Mm-hmm. They built long tracks that were not direct routes, so that they could overcharge the government for labor and for materials. And it really like began a process of convincing the government, and through convincing the government, then convincing the public that what they were doing was for the public good, despite the fact that it was destroying the environment, destroying people, mm-hmm. and consolidating power in a way that had never been seen in really human history. So the railroads really give you that a lens into that. I thought I'd throw that at you, because it reminds me so much of how the government functions today. The students were asking, how could this be? How could these elites, these industrialists, convince the government and the public that what they were doing was good and that they should be kind of above the law? I put mm-hmm. the HSBC up on the board and said, you know, go ahead and Google this and understand that even, you know, it doesn't even have to be HSBC. A better example would be JP Morgan, which is exactly the Gilded Age industrialist that we were studying mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. chapter was JP Morgan. And mm-hmm. JP Morgan as a financial institution is on the cover of the New York Times the day we're studying it for pretty much the precisely what the original JP Morgan was, which was defrauding the government.
In the name of rescuing the United States.
Right, right. So it's fascinating to see us still stuck with this same kind of template, and that something that was not a conversation at all about climate change in the 19th century has become, I feel like climate change is the conversation we were still having, just expressed in different terms, that the terms are much starker now. That's what was mm-hmm. done, what was done to the West is kind of done on a global scale.
Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, one of the uses that those tracks were put to was the extermination of the buffalo. Mm-hmm. So that you can see the rise of the corporate state, the predator corporate state, which is expanding throughout the West, and at the same time, the necessity of white colonization means that you have to, you know, remove all the remaining indigenous cultures and peoples off onto the reservations that are, you know, the camp zones for them. And so one way to get them into these zones is to destroy their way of life, which is to eradicate the buffalo, and millions and millions and millions of buffalo eradicated. And I think you can see right there that an ecological crisis set under the terms of an ecocidal event, mm-hmm. which is the destruction of this entire species, accompanies this form of political power in which there is a sovereign agent that rises above that of Republican government. Mm. And that sovereign agent is the corporate state, which then immediately turns to bending the laws of the state in the form of corporate personhood in the Santa Clara decision mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to manufacture a reality in which the primary benefits of the Bill of Rights would be corporations. Yeah. And that legal discourse is the one that we're still in operating today. And I think that would be something to talk about. But the other thing that I would respond to in your situation is, it's interesting how all of those white men, and they were exclusively white men, that ran those corporations and then bent the United States to their will following the assassination of Lincoln, were all pretty much collectively operating under the idea that they were Christians and that the United States was a Christian country. And I think that we shouldn't forget the kind of long durée of that mentality, because I think that their insatiable greed and their appetite for power is itself something that people like John Adams, one of the founding fathers, was trying to protect against when they invented a government that was full of these checks and balances, based on the precept that, and this is this problematizes the idea of this beast, the human being inside was full of this animal that needed to be tamed. And that according to the book of Genesis and all these
The original sin is what you're talking
about. That the human being was something that was responsible.
A fallen creature.
A fallen creature whose...
whose instincts were impure.
And whose sole message of life given to him by God in Genesis, in Cain and Abel, and in Noah was, you have dominion over the plants and the animals. And
yeah, that's what I wanted to get at. I was hoping you'd get here, because you're talking about like the killing of the buffalo and the extermination of Native Americans is an extermination of an ideology. It's an extermination of a way of looking. It's really like the killing of a set of eyes and a way of looking at the world that is so much in tension with the I hesitate to even call it Christian, but maybe the idea of not only dominion over the earth and domination over the earth, but the idea of human impulses themselves as
sick,
yeah,
pathological,
right?
And that's putting a psychological spin on it. But and also what gets to your point about we do this destruction in the name of good. Mm-hmm. So that this is creative destruction, according to economists like Schumpeter, that then gets taken up and bent into a sort of different frame with, you know, shock doctrine. And I want to talk about that in a minute, about the profiteering off of climate instability.
Right.
But it's this idea that because man is a fallen creature, you have these elites who are committing these frauds in the name of the public good, in the name of growth. And it's operating at the same time as social Darwinism, which says, you know, the economically strong should prosper over the dying weak, who are the poor. And mixed up in all of this, and I think this is true for colonization, for slavery, for social Darwinism, and for certainly certain attitudes that are still with us today. It's a contempt for people, and it's a contempt for life.
Yes.
And I really think that at the root of all of this is a psychotic contradiction in the minds of the Western elites, who projected their own dementias and their own political problems as something that was fundamentally true and universal for all of human nature.
Yeah.
And in doing so, they left an intellectual legacy where everyone thought that, you know, Kant and Hobbes, you know, human nature, the state of war, were describing real aspects of human character. And in reality, this was a small group of white elite who were in the midst of a vast colonization project,
right,
predicated on religious origins, and that behind those religious origins were not only we are here to dominate the earth in the name of production, which means the reason why we take over all this land in South America, North America, and Africa is to make it productive, to grow it.
Yeah.
It's that growth thing.
This is guns, germs, and steel is what I'm hearing from you a little bit.
That would be part of it, although what he leaves out is ideology.
Right.
He leaves out human agency.
Yeah.
Jared Diamond.
Yeah.
There's a geographical determinism in that book that lets off the hook 500 years of elite predation, you know, that is just mind-boggling. That's why that book is so popular among liberals.
Yeah,
it's because it takes the agency out of the equation. But it's that contempt, because I really think that what happens to all these extinct species, when I see what's happening to the neighborhoods in New York, where poor communities are left with these environmental disaster zones and brownfields and cancer rates, and when you see the toxic dumping in the rivers, there's a contempt for life.
Yeah,
it's purely contempt.
You know, and that contempt, I feel like is can be symbolized by so many things that have happened related to climate change, not only climate change, but environmental catastrophe, and the attitude that specifically energy corporations have towards extracting energy from the earth or extracting minerals from the earth. But for me, like, there's this weird, like, metaphorical rape that's going on. It's penetrative, and that's why I wanted to bring up fracking, because New York State is undergoing a significant battle about fracking right now, and it looks like Governor Cuomo is definitely on the side of allowing companies to frack in New York State, and there's been a I would say one of the largest activist reactions in the last few years has been towards this fracking issue, because I think a lot of people that understand the issue understand how serious it is. But to get back to that idea of, like, fracking, what it is is trying to extract a little bit of it's natural gas that they're getting, right? That's what the proposition is.
There's oil that they're actually getting at the very bottom of these shale formations, but I think there's also a lot of gas down there too, and so they're taking mostly gas and a little bit of oil.
Right,
and that's my understanding.
My understanding of it is also, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I feel like we're being once again duped by a J.P. Morgan type character that's and by that I mean a circle of small elites that see an opportunity to do something that will make them hundreds of millions of dollars in a quick turnaround, destroy the natural water supply of New York State, and then leave without providing energy really for anybody. I mean, you're talking about, they've talked about, like, it being like a couple weeks worth of energy. Like, they're willing to destroy the water supply of a state that's been around for or a state that has a population of millions and millions of people that depend on that water supply. They're willing to do that so that a few guys can turn around a couple $100 million worth of profit. I wish more people understood how sick an idea that is. And I want to let you respond to that, because before I do, I wanted to tell this quick thing about J.P. Morgan, because I read this yesterday about J.P. Morgan, that how he originally got his fortune was during the Civil War. I didn't know this, but that he came upon a warehouse full of broken rifles, and he bought the rifles very, very cheaply, cleaned them up, turned them around, went to the federal government and said, I'll sell you these rifles for $300,000. Which in today's money would be millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars. The federal government bought these rifles. J.P. Morgan defrauded them. They were broken, and they blew the thumbs off of the soldiers, hundreds of soldiers that used them in the Civil War. J.P. Morgan was charged with defrauding the federal government, and he paid off the federal judge who let him go without even a fine. So that's fracking. Can you, like, relate that to fracking a little? Because that's kind of what I feel is happening on a much, much, much more serious scale. Instead of broken guns that J.P. Morgan or whatever capitalist industrialist scumbag is selling the government. Instead of guns, it's the idea of drilling into a place that's very, very dangerous, so that they can make some money.
Mm-hmm. Well, it exploits a crisis that they are constantly creating. So, you know, part of the solution that they're offering to politicians is a solution to a problem that they created. And the problem they created was, we're going to take all the manufacturing jobs in upstate New York and we're going to ship them overseas. Now you have a jobs crisis. And so, you know, it's very tempting for a politician who's running on 4-year election cycles to want to say to upstate voters, particularly someone like Cuomo, you know, I've done something for your community besides open up more prisons and or try to take away your guns, which is, you know, I think part of the perception of the upstate perception of Cuomo.
Right.
And so in exploiting the situation, they're doing it for their own profit and their own gain, but it's going to come at the immediate cost to the health of the community.
So what does that cause? Because I'm sitting here being like, it'll pollute the water supply, and I actually don't know as much about it as you do. So what are the dangers with fracking? I know there have been earthquakes in Ohio.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that when you frack along fault lines that are somewhat inactive, like in Ohio, you can activate theoretically some of those fault lines. And, you know, I don't know what the fault lines are in New York City. I think the water aspect is something good to focus on, but so is, again, the carbon production. So that, you know, what's going to happen with the water is, when, in order to get to the oil and the gas, and this is, by the way, like sucking the very bottom of the milkshake. That's what fracking is. Mm, you know, I suck your milkshake. Yes, you know, yes, that yes, thing. Yes. You should do that impression sometime. Right. You're very good at it. This is from Daniel Day-Lewis, There Will Be Blood. Yeah, I suck your milkshake. So the fracking is all the milk that's left.
Interesting that he played Lincoln in the next movie, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And so fracking is all the milkshake that's left in the ground of North America from the oil booms of the 19th and 20th centuries. Mm-hmm. And what's,
yeah, we're scraping the bottom at this point.
Yeah, and the thing is, what we're finding, though, is the bottom goes down pretty
Shouldn't just that be alarming to people? Shouldn't that be like, hold on, we're scraping the bottom? Maybe... for me, the fact that we are continue to be in a series of disastrous wars in the Middle East that have not only destroyed the lives of millions of people in the Middle East and destroyed the environment of the Middle East, but have also, you know, damaged relationship between the United States and these countries for a very long time, but have also sacrificed our principles in dramatic ways. You know, we've gone to torture and drones, and that's a whole other show. But either way, that feels like scraping the bottom too. You know what I mean? That whole process of war and terrorism and everything else that's going on with the relationship of the Middle East, as we understand it is almost entirely energy related. Mm-hmm. Although, mm-hmm. Ideology and hegemony and religion and all these things function on that playing field, but they wouldn't function without energy being the without a big pool of oil being underneath mm-hmm. the Middle East. So that's scraping the bottom too, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. the fact that we're willing to do this and sacrifice the blood.
Yes, sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Is because we want the treasure.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not we. It's just it's a small group of people who have essentially much more power over our political system.
I would say, but other people would say we, because they would say, well, the American consumer likes the lifestyle that's predicated on access to cheap fossil fuel, whether they connect it to it that way or not. That's we want it.
Yeah, but I think then you could
George W. Bush did us a favor by going to
it. Yeah, I think you could say that, and at the same time, when you actually ask people, you know, is it worth it? Most people say no. And, right. I think that most people are, and this is the problem with the elites projecting their own contempt for humanity and their own greed as a fundamental aspect of human nature, that Hobbesian state of war, that if without...
It's the fallen thing again.
It's fallen, like, man,
you
right.
want it. You want, exactly. You want that Hummer.
And it's blaming the victims.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing this for you. We're doing this right. in your name. But here's the thing, David. No one is doing this for themselves. And the thing is, if you left people alone, they wouldn't do it. They just, they would not do it. Yeah. When you ask people, okay, do you want slightly more expensive, name the product, or do you want poison drinking water? They're going to say, I'll just go ahead and pay a little bit more. I think most people are much more moral than the elite philosophers of the 17th mm-hmm. century could ever have suspected, or the founding fathers like John Adams, who wrote an essay before 1776 in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, entitled All Men Would Be Tyrants If They Could. Mm. You know, that's the Hobbesian problem. That's the problem. And
if people are good, then why are we destroying the planet? You know what I mean? Like, if people...
Because I really don't think most people are.
You think it's elites that are directing this.
Yeah, it absolutely is elites and that are organizing it and sustaining it. There are the vast majority of people in public opinion polls don't want this.
And not necessarily a satanic worship or Satan worshiping Illuminati.
No. People that are...
We're talking about the Jamie Dimons of the world, right? Yeah. I mean, we can name them. I mean, I don't want to just hang it on him, but we can name them.
And it really is the same... It's an expanding group of families. You know, when you talk about the JP Morgans, there's a reason why, you know, they're generationally interconnected.
Right.
The political system is, I mean, look at the Bush Clinton thing talked about earlier.
Yeah.
It's generationally interconnected. There is a consistent, sustainable elite that goes back at least 100 years.
I'm glad you brought up the Bush Clinton thing again, because we talk about politics a lot on the show, and I'd like to maybe shift away from politics a little bit. But either way, Bush Clinton to 2016, you know, if we have that again, it feels like we cannot look to the political system in order to turn the ship around. And yet, if not, then what does that mean for the future of the planet? What does that mean in order, and that gets us back to, like, what needs to happen in order to survive? It gets us to people start identifying with like eco-terrorists. You know what I mean? And I mean that as like you start to see very, very radical
reactions. The reactions are going to turn into distorted versions of that. So people won't become eco-terrorists. We're going to see a rise of a fascist movement.
Right.
It's going to be more extreme than the Tea Party.
Right. And because I mean, we're sitting here assuming that, well, we're connecting climate change to all the to capitalism and to liberalism, really, and the corporate state and all that kind of stuff. But when the shit goes down, and by that I mean when climate change becomes more immediate than it already is, and I think it is pretty immediate. I mean, we started the show with Hurricane Sandy; it already is starting to get immediate. So when it becomes even more immediate and we start seeing like large diasporas and movements of people and more catastrophic stuff that's really like taxing the system to the point of to breaking, I don't think everybody's going to interpret it as, oh, this is capitalism that did this, or this is liberalism that did this, or this is the corporate state. You're going to have people that see it as a religious thing. You're going to have people that see it as...
Good point.
You know, you're going to have people that see... I could see... you know, and I don't want to get into like sci-fi scenarios, but I could see, you know, the rise of, and you just mentioned it, fascist groups, religious mm-hmm. cults, every kind of interpretation of what climate change actually is. In other words, our interpretation of this kind of, we have as imaginative as our thinking can get, I think that we both have a kind of practical, rational, logical, we're trying to figure out why, what are the nuts and bolts of climate change? Like, mm-hmm. why did this literally happen? And it happened because states, corporate states, or states themselves allowed capitalism, a dominion over the planet that led to this process, mm-hmm. that led to a reaction from the Earth in some way, mm-hmm. or at least stimulated some sort of process. So if other people have different interpretations, how do we navigate all that?
Well, those other interpretations have already begun. You know, you look at the Alex Jones, the climate denial movement is actually really fascinating because it's predicated on a mistrust of government.
Yes.
I'm extremely sympathetic to that.
Right.
I don't buy for a second the stupid literature that's produced out of that movement, whether it's genuine, which is the followers of Alex Jones, or
who basically, just to summarize what you're calling stupid, is the idea that climate change is basically a conspiracy by the left.
Yeah, it's a leftist conspiracy
in order to sell us
socialist and communism.
I showed you that, or I sent you that trailer from the CPAC thing that's going on right now. That conservatives are mm-hmm. all laughing at this fake trailer for a sci-fi movie that was about like the enslavement of having to buy, you know, light bulbs and things like that. And it was basically the fear that climate change and mainly climate change was going to be manipulated by the Obama administration as a way to secure the entitlement welfare state.
Well, you know,
it's
a weird idea, but the Democratic Party is a useful target for all sides because it's the only political party in the United States that's doing anything about climate change. And the ways that it's handling it are inappropriate, short-sighted, and stupid.
Yeah.
And
ripe for parody. I mean, I think...
And ripe for parody.
South Park did a... they've done a lot of stuff making fun of Al Gore, but they did a long episode about his Inconvenient Truth tour. And, I mean, this made him look like a hysterical hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the fact that the show was a hit on climate change as an idea, I couldn't disagree with their portrayal of Al Gore, right? And so that's kind of an entryway for people. Climate change gets kind of encapsulated within these Democratic figures that are awful.
Oh, awful! And if you, the problem with Al Gore again is that he used this. It's shock doctrine. It's Naomi Klein. He used climate change to sell product.
Yes,
you know, it's like Walmart increased its sales of those light bulbs as a direct result of that film,
right,
you know, within a 5 to 10 year period. So, I mean, that's the solution to climate change is not green consumption. That's the greenwashing term, which means that corporations take over terms like sustainability, mm-hmm. bend them into something that's profitable, and then remarket them to people so that everyone can kind of feel good. It's the Starbucks plastic water bottle mm-hmm. that says 5 cents of this purchase goes back to people in sub-Saharan countries where water is in crisis.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, and
recycling is even the same.
It's the same thing. And it also, it's I've all predicated on the response that your individual consumption is the problem and is the solution.
Right.
When nothing could be further from the truth.
Right. And those efforts like the light bulb, like recycling, like Starbucks throwing a penny at a third world country when you buy a coffee, those things don't address the system ever.
Yeah. How about this? Al Gore, the number one consumer of oil is the U.S. military, which means the number one producer of carbon emissions from vehicles and all those other kinds of equipment is the U.S. military. So why don't you end the 11th hour? Excuse me. I always get that. Why don't you end an inconvenient truth with a idea of dismantling the U.S. military industrial system? Right. Oh, because that's not going to be popular because you're attacking the U.S. security state, which is, like the energy companies, one of those peripheral industries that profits immensely from the disasters.
And those are unquestionable. Those things must exist.
Unquestionable.
Just, like you call them pillars, and in my head I have them as just, they're just stone pillars that are not moved. You know, like certain things are not going to move. One of the things that's not going to move is the military industrial complex. And despite the fact that, you know, there's this big like kind of fake fight we're having about the budget right now, and then Obama's going to cut the military. Don't believe it. It's not real. You know, it's not the kind of substantive budgetary change towards the military. In other words, Obama can get the biggest cut ever of the military, right? He can get the biggest cut in the last 50 years, and we'll still have an incredibly grossly inflated military budget that is unquestionable and unshakable.
And we need to do a future show on the political economy of national security. That is a show talking about the Cold War to the present.
Well,
I just want to respond real quick to you is going back to an earlier point you were making about the sort of different various millennial formations that the climate culture will take, even if it's not a direct activism or advocacy. And I also just want to just emphasize to our listeners that there are movements that are working against climate instability and climate change. There is climate activism, there is climate justice, and that these movements are global. And we also should acknowledge that these networks still have time to be effective. And I think that the minute we think that they're not going to be effective for any reason, even if it's just sheer pessimism, we're actually just giving in already. And you might as well just go jump out of a window.
Because so what are those efforts? And what are the kinds of things you're talking about?
One of the things, and you know, this is a complicated conversation. There's voices on all sides. But for instance, the Keystone Pipeline conflict.
Yes.
So should the United States build a pipeline from the Canadian tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico? And this actually navigates to one of your point, which is, who does this actually benefit? One thing that is recent in the news that people should know about is that, you know, this pipeline, which has been delayed by the Obama administration until the summer, which the Obama administration is going to allow in June, and John Kerry, Secretary of State, I read this, is going to be the one that delivers that speech and justify it. The State Department has said
what a sad decline for John Kerry.
Yeah.
Or you know what?
He's a mixed figure.
What a triumphant rise for John Kerry.
Yeah, he's a mixed. There's a show right there, John Kerry, because you know he was the one that went after the CIA in the 80s for the drugs.
Yeah.
I'll never forget, you know, that Iran-Contra, everything.
His speech on the Vietnam thing in the Senate was amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's the guy that was like, "How do you?" His quote was, "How do you ask someone to be the last man to die for a lie?" Mm-hmm. That's powerful stuff. I mean, and his whole speech was poetic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a Vietnam guy, so that's why I kind of think of John Kerry as this figure, just like Al Gore, in a sense of like a person that was kind of a little bit of a radical, even Barack Obama. So a little bit of a radical in their youth that then channeled that radicalism into.
Same with Clinton.
Yeah. Same with Clinton. Channeled that radicalism into ultimately becoming almost Illuminati figure.
They're all baby boomers in a weird way. Yeah. They are all boomers. And Obama, who ran in 2008 on that, he was past the baby boomer. He is just like a baby boomer.
Enjoying the dark side. And they employ that, but they employ that the radical language. I wouldn't say radical. I wouldn't even say radical, but
progressive.
But, yeah. They employ that language very, very well. And they obviously stroke the chords of a big part of the American electorate.
The boomers.
Yes.
And they will live and die in their success. Has hinged on the boomers on both sides of the parties. But I just want to say one thing about Keystone, which is the State Department said it was environmentally sound. That's what gave Obama and Kerry and Clinton the cover to go ahead and allow this thing. And again, I'm working on the assumption that it's allowed and that maybe I'll be turned out to be wrong, but that's what I've been reading. Well, what's interesting about that is the State Department outsourced the writing of the environmental report to a public relations firm that is directly employed by some of the energy companies that are the ones building the pipeline. And the media is just shitting that into silence. And it's just it's amazing that that hasn't been called
out. Can you explain that one more time, like what that means? What you just said about the State Department.
The State Department didn't go to an independent source or, like, you know, independent scientists or produce a committee with independent voices. They didn't even write the report themselves.
Right.
So it gets the narrative in the headline of the New York Times is State Department says environmental risks for Keystone contained. That's the headline.
And the State Department got their information from?
From a group that they hired to write this report and study the issues. But that group is employed by the companies building the pipeline.
Right. And it reminds me of a student brought up when we were talking about climate change a couple weeks ago that there are scientists that say that climate change is not real. And I said to myself, or I said to the student, that, you know, and we've mentioned this before, there is a more than a global consensus of scientists. And I thought to myself, though, only that 1% of scientists that are saying that climate change is not real, I just have to assume that they work for an oil company.
A very large proportion of them do.
Yeah. In other words, one way of putting it is, who's getting paid by who? And you can figure out why people are saying things based on who they work for.
That's right. And another thing of who benefits. So the argument is this pipeline will create jobs and create taxes in the states that it runs through, et cetera. So
jobs is such a buzzword lately, isn't it? Just jobs.
That's right. And you know,
it's like I want to build a big giant laser that I'm going to use to shoot at China. But it's going to create 1,500 jobs.
Yeah.
We need jobs.
Well, David, you know, the laser is the U.S. prison industrial system. Right, you know, that's the thing.
And that thing about jobs is what handcuffs the labor movement in the United States. So what handcuffs the unions, because the unions are pro Keystone, right?
You know,
from what I understand, I
believe it.
There's a lot of unions,
but I haven't looked into the issue.
So it's so sad because it's like at the working class are asked to or forced to be accomplices in the murder of the earth that sustains them.
Right.
And you know what I mean? Which is a similar
critique to colonization itself.
Yeah,
global
they're
colonization.
Forced to be accomplices in their own genocide.
Yeah, and you know, and that thing is in the history of colonization. That was the kind of there were elite groups in the countries that were being, or the nations or the cultures that were being colonized, that became complicit with the colonizers, and you know, that tension is part of the story. But who benefits? The natural gas, and this is also something that's been muted in the for-profit corporate media. The natural gas that will be produced out of these tar sands, or the oil, excuse me, and then will go to the Gulf of Mexico, will be exported. So when people say this will bring down the cost of energy for American citizens, it's patently untrue.
This is the drill, baby, drill argument, right?
Why
are we at war in the Middle East? We could just drill here in the United States and get enough oil to run the American
system,
which is an absolute, just not only a distortion, but an outright lie. I mean,
there's only 6 months worth of oil for the U.S. economy in Anwar, in Alaska. And remember Deepwater Horizon?
So we're going to kill Bambi for 6 months?
Yep. And remember Kunstler's point in that lecture
six months of Taco Bell.
Remember when he came to talk to my class and at Skidmore?
James Howard Kunstler, the author of Long Emergency.
The entire Deepwater Gulf disaster.
Mm-hmm.
That extraction project.
Deepwater Horizon, BP oil, summer 2000.
That itself was only for 3 to 6 months supply of oil
it's
for the U.S.
And that
goes back to the fracking debate that you're having in New York. It's the short-termism disease.
And this is the American eyes and the Western eyes. And this is what died with the Native Americans. And we hate to, you know, do the whole like romanticizing the way of life of Native Americans. It's not what we're doing. But what we are recognizing is that something shifted at that moment, something shifted to seeing things in a different way. To give you another example, that whole like I think it was in Daniel Pinchbeck's Breaking Open the Head, he made the point that there are areas of the Amazon, well, most of the Amazon rainforest is being destroyed for oil, right? And he talked about how the tribes the indigenous tribes that lived there for tens of thousands of years in these forests, they would, whenever they did anything to the natural environment, from cutting off a piece of bark or killing an animal, they would do a kind of ritualistic thought that was, they would try to project what the effect of this change would be on that area of the earth for the next 10,000 years, right? Mm-hmm. So they would, by cutting down this tree, what's the effect going to be for the next 10,000 years? And they had a very long view, in other words, of like their place in the universe, mm-hmm. and their place as caretakers of the planet. Now, to contrast that with the oil company that's currently in the Amazon, when they cut down trees, when they do changes to that earth in the place where these indigenous tribes have been pushed out of or dislocated or killed,
mm-hmm.
They're gone. The oil company's there now, and when they cut down a tree, and they would cut down whole forests, they feed the Western and mostly American oil supply for a period of a couple weeks. So it's like destroying an entire forest for a couple weeks of sitting in a drive-through at Taco mm-hmm. Bell, mm-hmm. and that to me gets to the heart of the difference between these two ideologies. And I don't even know what the names of the ideologies are. I guess it's materialist and anti-material, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, but go ahead.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because some of the reading that I've been doing, that I've been speaking from a little bit in these last couple shows, is speaking directly to that. Earlier, I was speaking from a really short book that anybody should read called The Western Illusion of Human Nature by Marshall Sahlins, Sahlins. But then one of the things that you're talking about is this idea of dominionism, which is people that are interested in like colonial ecology, you know, mm-hmm. people that are interested in all these connections that you're making here. There's a book by Jim Mason called An Unnatural Order, and exactly this conflict between like the kind of Christian capitalist white West and the indigenous cultures that it overtook and colonized and destroyed. And the reason he uses the word dominionism is to say that the conquest of the land was bound up in the conquest and the eradication of the peoples and the animals. But one of the other fulcrum points that he makes, mm-hmm. that you just said, that really lights up my mind, is that for him, he says that in order for us to understand the sort of ecological, homicidal Western mind, is to look at the relationship of people to animals, mm-hmm. as the bridge to nature itself, mm-hmm. you know, nature in quotes, to the larger question of the human relationship to the ecology.
Right.
And one of the things he said that is really interesting about indigenous cultures that believed in the kind of the spiritual life of animals and plants, mm-hmm. is that, you know, because Christianity said it's just men that have souls,
yes,
and
yes.
you're ruled by
I love
God.
This idea.
There's that
yeah.
dualism.
Yeah, only we have souls.
Yeah, and yeah. and Christianity is really a mythology that validates agriculture,
mm-hmm.
because in the ways that I suggested earlier, that it's all about producing land and people's ownership over the land. It's fundamentally an agricultural religion.
It's about changing the land.
Yeah,
yeah.
And about extraction. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that goes back to this idea of the 10,000 years ahead is that, you know, when you remove something sacred and spiritual from animals and plants, and even particularly animals, and you're able to destroy them because they're no longer looked upon as sacred or even valuable or even as a life, you have contempt for that thing. Mm-hmm. That thing is only going to harm you. That's one of the roots, religiously, culturally, politically, you know, everything, in terms of getting at how is it that our mind allows this to happen. And Lynn White has an essay, I think it's back in the 60s, called The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis.
Mm.
And he talks about exactly that. For him, the way to understand everything that's happening right now with climate instability, climate justice, climate change, et cetera, is that one of the key moments in this entire sequence of events was the destruction of animal paganism.
Mm.
This idea that mm-hmm. the animals were the bridge to our understanding that we were in a relationship
right.
with ecological life, and that these animals were bridge figures.
Yeah.
And that as we eradicated them and other people who believed in their sacredness,
yes.
we destroyed an intellectual, religious, spiritual foundation and a set of tools, a set of thinking and feeling tools that delivered us into the situation we find ourselves now with barren internal resources mm-hmm. for understanding the alternatives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's great stuff. I feel like what you're describing is the beast, you know, is the beast coming out of the earth
and the thing that
and changing yeah. the earth, and literally like
But I would just put pressure on that real fast by saying,
yeah,
we've got to stop associating the bad thing with the beast.
Yeah.
we cannot say that the beast is the problem in us.
Right.
We have to allow ourselves a kind of comfort and a kind of sacredness of the beast.
Mm.
You know, it's our category of the human that's the problem.
Yes.
We need to see ourselves as animals and respect the beast.
And you know, that gets to like how big this project of climate change
exactly
is. And
exactly.
Like climate change is actually like puts it to us, like,
yep,
puts it in
this
our
is
face.
Yep, this is the central, this is the
you are by that idea.
David, this is the central crisis of the West,
right?
You know, and it's
like, it's like here it is in our face,
which
and
is,
like,
which
look,
is
mm-hmm. look what you've done, and I don't know if I mentioned this before, but like, you know, we live in New York with the East River and the Hudson River, and it's like you can't even, this river was there for millions of years, you could drink out of it, but once that dominionism idea gets to New York, within 200 years, both of those rivers are toxic. You can't touch them. And what kind of system can do that? It's a system that has an attitude towards nature that is murderous.
What we don't need to shut down is the economy. We need to shut down that part of our minds.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. I think that's a good note to end on. We came up with some. I think good ideas here, and when I say good, I think they're somewhat frightening ideas, but at the same time, they give us a way of they give me a way of framing kind of what's happening, because I don't like to it's depressing when you read about fracking,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think it's somewhat comforting, at least for me, to be able to frame fracking within a larger framework of what's been going on for the last few hundred years, and mm-hmm. understand it as, I mean, not necessarily excuse it or think it or be okay with it or accept it, but to understand the nature of what we're dealing with here, which is our minds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we need to change our minds somehow, and that's a process that requires a lot of work.
Yeah, and there are people and groups and ideas around us that offer us alternatives in our ways of thinking.
Yeah. Who are those groups, by the way?
Are
you talking about Oprah's channel, her new channel?
There it is. And what I would also say, though, by way of conclusion, is just I think that I will continue to pressure you, and I feel bad for your listeners, to have a third show on climate change sometime in the future.
I knew this would happen. You know, because when, maybe we'll leave with this idea, but I thought about when we were talking about the show or thinking about doing another climate change, I thought I wanted to get to some of the larger kind of philosophical, ideological issues beyond just like what's Obama going to do about it, mm-hmm. you know, or what's Alex Jones think mm-hmm. about it. And I was like, what are we really talking about here? And for me, it's like I kind of came to this stuff through almost a psychedelic viewpoint, like James Lovelock's Gaia theory, right? The idea that like the Earth is one organism, and that we at this point, at least in our history, humans are functioning as a virus on the Earth, a kind of and that the Earth is reacting. The Earth is creating has a nervous system, in other words, or an immune system, and it's kind of creating climate change and heating up like an organism would get a fever to expel a virus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that climate change is actually a biological process of the planet as an entire entity. And I wanted to throw that idea out too, because
but the contagion is the elite,
right?
And we are the immunity.
I think that's
We can solve the human virus, because we are the answer to ourselves.
I think that's a nice way of ending, because it understands humanity not as just one monolithic virus, but as that humanity in all its dynamism and all its virtuosity and all its kind of its diversity. That we're not just the elite virus. That we actually are creatures of extraordinary power and consciousness, and that we can turn this ship around. If we start getting real creative. And I think that's kind of why I'm so excited to live in a time of extreme climate crisis, even though it sounds like a really devastating emergency and a hellish thing to go through. At the same time, it opens up tremendous possibilities to express what's unique and powerful about humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can all stay tuned for the next 40, 50 years. We're going to see some tremendous stuff happen. And I'm just waiting for those moments. I think it's a scary but also exciting time to be alive.
Yeah, and we're going to make those moments happen.
I hope so.
We are the agents. We really are.
I hope so.
We can't sign that off to someone else.
No. It's very clear that we have been
my representative
been called
is not
the
agent.
Bench.
Yeah.
To use a sports metaphor, we've been called from the bench.
Yep.
Where it's time.
I'm not going to vote for change.
Right.
I'm going to be the change.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's great. Okay. So thanks a lot, Justin. And we will talk to you next
time. Cheers.